and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone who changed a lot of their lives in a major way, one of the OGs from one of the original punk scenes, in my opinion, Craig Bell of Cleveland band The Mirrors, of the legendary Rocket from the Tombs, also of the Saucers, currently playing with the Gizmos, does stuff with Simply Saucer. God, this is a good one. This is why I do this thing, is so I can have these sorts of conversations with these kinds of people. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can find me on that Twitter thing or that Instagram at Left for Damian. There is a YouTube page, an Instagram page, a TikTok page, a Facebook page, all for Turned Out of Punk. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. If you want to support this show, tell all your friends about it. Let them know that you enjoy this podcast. I also play in a band. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. Like shows and stuff that we're playing or records that we put out, merchandise, what have you. Head over there. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, this is why I do this thing. Today we are talking to Craig Bell of The Mirrors, of Rockets from the Tombs, of the Saucers, of just like countless unbelievable bands. And the Cleveland scene that these bands are a part of, to me, is, I'm not going to waste your time, you're going to hear me talk about this a lot in a second. Huge thank you to friend of the show, William Sibley, who helped set this up. He's helped us in the past set up other guests too. So this is like a huge thank you to William for this, because I ran into, once again, you're going to hear this in a second, but I ran into Craig years ago. And as he walked away, I thought, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't set up a podcast with this guy, but here it is. So thank you, William. You can also find out more information about Craig, including a incredible selection of Rock from the Tombs merchandise, and as well as other projects that Craig's been involved in, including like an original Saucer single that are all very fairly priced, as well as the new records and some of the newer projects that Craig's involved in as well, over at craigbell.com. And there's tons of stuff to look at on this website over there. But Craig is also findable on Instagram over at at EVCLAM. And check it out. Check out everything Craig does. Maybe I should explain Rocket from the Tombs to people that don't know. I feel like this is now kind of just part of the lexicon. For a long time, it wasn't, but now it is. Rock from the Tombs, not to be confused with Rock from the Crypt, who are named in tribute to Rock from the Tombs, as you can hear on John Reese's episode, we talk about this. Rock from the Tombs are one of the greatest bands of all time. Like, they would break up, and out of their ashes would come genius Peter Lautner, but got way too short in his career by tragic circumstances, but also Pere Ubu, as well as the Dead Boys. This band is one of those great what could have been, what should have been in rock and roll, as well as the Mirrors, Electric Eels, like X-Blank X, Pagans later on. There's just so much stuff in this Cleveland scene that you need to dig into. You know I love Cleveland in every era, but this era, whew, foundational. Okay, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Check out craigbell.com. Thank you again to William. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Craig Bell on Turned Out of Punk. Craig, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Damian. Thank you for having me.
As I told you off air, that this is not the first time we have met, and I think I mentioned it to you the first time that I met you, that you are an incredibly important person in not only my musical journey, but I think the journey of rock and roll. And so to finally be able to sit down and talk to you for this thing, that's a huge thrill for me. This is a big one.
Well, thank you, Damien. That really is a very heartfelt and humbling intro, but I appreciate it and thank you very much. And under the circumstance that we met was hilarious anyway. I remember at the end of talking to you, I just turned around and said, "Man, I love Canada."
It was actually my wife Lauren pointed out and said, "See, that guy's over there's wearing a pink Gizmos t-shirt." And so I went up to you and I was like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe that Gizmos t-shirt. That's amazing. One of my favorite bands." And you said, "Oh, I play in them." And then you introduced yourself and I was, "Oh my," like the Saucers, like obviously Rocket from the Tomb. Like there's just so many different scenes and bands that you've been involved with that I love independently, and to have them all connected through you. This might be four parts in the making, so I apologize in advance for the length of this conversation.
Oh, no, not at all. My afternoon is free.
Well, I got to start them off the way they all start off, which is, Craig, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it? Or the term, even.
Well, the term, the term had a way different connotation when I started playing music, because I started in the late 70s, right out, about a year out of high school, I joined my first band, Mirrors, in Cleveland. And we, the term punk wasn't really around at that time. It had been mentioned in magazines here and there, but as for slapping it on a certain genre, the genre we considered ourselves was underground, which was kind of the thing in those days for bands that weren't of the mainstream, people that we admired, people like the Velvet Underground and what have you. So punk didn't really come along until I had moved to Connecticut, I guess right before I moved to Connecticut, when the Ramones came around, and that the term punk started getting thrown around quite a bit more.
Well, I find it fascinating because you brought up the Velvet Underground and of course the Stooges and the MC5. There's sort of these proto-punk bands.
City of Detroit.
Exactly. But I think those bands, their goal was to become rock stars still. You see the old interviews with them. And I think it's fascinating because, like you said, you guys were described yourselves as being underground. And I think that's the birth of punk in a way that the metric was different with what you guys were doing, where it's...
Well, no, I can't cop to that, because I wanted to be John Entwistle skeet shooting my gold records. I definitely want to do that. I wanted to have a stable of cars. I mean, I wanted the whole, the whole rock star thing. I mean, the over the topness of it that came along later than 1971. But in 1971, I mean, our goal was to get signed to a major label. Our goal was to be able to make records and be able to get our music out in front of people. And the more people we get in front of, the better. That was our goal. Even when I was playing with Saucers and things like that, I mean, we wanted to get in front of people and we wanted people to hear what we were doing. Kind of learned early on that, the success is, hitting that jackpot is like hitting the jackpot. So the main thing was the fire was there to go and make the music, and hopefully the wealth would come. Well, I don't know. I'm doing okay. I got this house,
Well, I, as a long line of people that's like, I'm doing okay through this thing, I think it's sort of like what you're describing, like what you wanted to do was be like your heroes in these bands that have came before you. And I feel like that's kind of like what this genre is, punk, because there is obviously bands that wind up getting massively commercially successful out of this thing.
Oh yes.
But for the most part, it's just about contributing to this history and this zeitgeist and this energy that just continues to kind of fuel bands where, yeah, maybe we all ultimately wish we were John Entwistle, shooting the gold records with the skeet shoot.
Of course we do.
But there's also the idea that there's another metric for success, like the Velvet Underground. Lou definitely did some wild shit, but I don't know if he ever got to that level with what he was doing. But at the same time, they are a successful band because what they did was true and pure, and still rings true and pure to this day. And I say the same thing about the stuff you guys were doing in the mirrors. Like, it wasn't
That's the
commercial.
kind of thing, that's what we were striving for, because, especially with mirrors, when Jamie and Jim brought me into the band, I mean, we were basically a Velvet Underground cover band with a couple other songs thrown in. And we loved it, and we admired these guys so much, and that music meant so much to us, and it resonated so much with us that we wanted to bring it in, filter it through us, and push it back out. And that's what we did. And that's what I've been doing since then. I mean, I still, my basic core, when people ask me, well, what do you sound like? And I go, I'm a cross between the Velvet Underground, the Kinks, and Creedence Clearwater. And they look at me funny, and they think about it for a second, and they go, oh yeah. And I'm thinking, yeah.
So, what was your entry point to music, I guess, going back to that?
Just like everybody else. Well, actually, the entry to me initially was the radio. I remember when I was about 6 years old, in around 1958, I lived in Cheektowaga, New York.
We're neighbors.
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
in Toronto,
yes.
right? So.
Yeah, oh, yeah. In fact, we used to go, I remember going up to the beaches on Lake Ontario in Canada because they were nicer than Lake Erie. But
Yes.
I was very young then, but I remember sitting at Memorial Day and listening all afternoon to the Indy 500 on the radio while, we had a pool party with our neighbors and things. But after that, I became fascinated with the radio and I started listening and seeing how many stations I could hear. So naturally, I started listening to like the pop music of the late 50s, early 60s, and things like that. And then what, yesterday, 60 years ago, was the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And just like everybody, every other kid, that was like, boom, that was it. I was ready. I was like, this is interesting. This is something I want to get, I want to get to know more about. And from there, I think it was maybe the summer after that, I went with a friend to the movies to see the Jerry and the Pacemakers movie, Ferry Across the Mersey. I
Absolutely.
think we sat through it like three times. And on the way home, I said to my friend Dave, I said, I think I want to be in a rock and roll band. And he goes, me too. So we both started trying to figure out how to do that. He became a drummer and he played for a while, but I was kind of hamstrung because my father was not a fan of any kind of rock music or anything, and the idea of trying to get a guitar into the house was not going to work out. He suggested I play some real music, so I took clarinet lessons and things like that through school, and so I got a little rudimentary, into music itself. And then after I graduated from high school, that's when I started looking to join a band, and I ran into Jim Crook one day, who was the lead guitarist in Mirrors. He had been dating a friend of mine through high school. He was a couple years older than us, but I met him. He went to a different school, but I met him through his girlfriend, who is a friend of mine. And he had just come home from Vietnam. I think it was in about April, May of 71. And the remnants of the Velvet Underground without Lou, like Doug Yule and I think Sterling and Walter Powers and Maureen Tucker played Cleveland. So I went to the show naturally, and Jim was there. And I was like, oh, Jim, hey, you're home. Hey, what are you doing? He said, oh, me and my friend Jamie are trying to start a band. And I said, oh, I want to be in a band. So that was it. They invited me over. We sat around, played records, talked for a while, and they decided that I was going to be in the band. So they handed me a bass guitar. Jamie tuned it for me and showed me, how to tune it and what each string was. And then he just said, figure out the rest of it for yourself. So, started playing with those guys. And my friend Michael joined us as a drummer. He wasn't even a drummer, he was a guitar player in a band in high school that I used to hang out with. Like I would be their roadie since I couldn't, play. And
What band was that?
pardon me?
What band was that? Do they have a
That
name?
was Mirrors.
Oh, that was
Oh, the high school band. It was called the River's Edge. And it was like a high school cover band that Mike Weldon played the guitar in.
Because
And
I was looking today, like Paul Murata had a like he had the Tool record that he put out, right? And then
yes,
there's and Peter Lautner. Oh, you
I
have
have
three.
one right here in this box. I've got one of those.
Oh man, there's that one song. I've only heard the one song that's out on YouTube, but that song is so great. It's got that line, tune out on acid, tuning my guitar. What a great line.
It was quite a feat at the time that Paul put that record out, because people just weren't doing that. Same thing with Peter Lochner. He put out this album called Notes on a Cocktail Napkin, probably, I don't know, 72, 71, somewhere around in there.
I think it's 70 even. I just 'cause I was looking it up today before I got on the phone with you. Like it is like arguably the first two DIY records for punk kind of thing, all proto-punk obviously, but
Yeah, bro, it was, but it was quite, I mean, just at the time, the idea, I mean, in Mirrors, we'd sit around and go, oh man, we'd like to make a record. How do you make a record? That's why you said you got to get signed to a record company. They're the people that make the records. We don't know how to make records. How do you make a record? And that kind of, that was one of the great things about the punk movement, was that people just said, screw it, we're going to make a record. And by the time I got to Connecticut, people were doing that, and I met some of them and said, "Well, how do you do this?" And they said, "Oh, you send it here, do this." Or back at Trouser Press magazine, they'd have a ad for some place, and that's how the first Saucer single came around, was just the whole DIY movement.
Yeah, because it's like you're saying it was so hard to put a record at, it's hard today to put a vinyl record, but back then it was like it next to impossible. There's no internet to turn to. There's no roadmap to follow.
No, but there was a collective of fanzines and a network of people and things like that. You had to really dig deep to get out of your own little area. But even like when the first Saucer single, I took it around to every college radio station in southern New England personally. I took a knapsack full of them down to New York one day and spent a weekend walking from the top of Manhattan, well, subway, and walking the top of Manhattan to the bottom, going to every record store trying to get some in on even on consignment. Peter Horsapple from the DBs was working at a record store somewhere in Manhattan and bought five copies of it from me. He was the only person who actually bought them. He actually financed my weekend in New York by buying those five records, so I had enough money to eat something. And this is how you, and you would send you would I remember sitting in and stuffing records into envelopes with a letter and sending them all over the country, all over the world. That's just what you had to do and hope that somebody would write you back.
Well, and I find that so interesting too, because you guys have that network, and obviously that network becomes what punk and hardcore is still built on to this day, like this
Yes,
sort of
absolutely.
international.
That was the foundation. There was a lot of people like Greg Shaw and the guy who started SST, the folks that ran Homestead and things like that. I mean, they were real pioneers, young people wanting to, break out the stranglehold that the big labels had on people. And to a certain extent, they did.
And I know there was like going back to even pre-SST and pre Homestead, like going back to when you guys were kind of first starting out, I found there was some connection, and it's through fanzines, I guess, with Simply Saucer and The Nerves and like some of these other bands that were proto-punk, Gizmos, I guess, also part of that thing too. Like there is seemingly contact, right? Like were you guys aware of like some of these other bands that were popping up around then? I guess no one had records really though.
I was aware of the Nerves in the early 70s. When I moved to Connecticut, I became aware of the Nerves. And through magazines, you heard about other bands also, but you may not have heard their music until later. A lot of times now, Simply Saucer, I happened to meet Edgar. Him and I were both members of the Syd Barrett fan club.
That's awesome.
So that's when we first met each other. That was probably as pen pals, 1973. And he was writing me, telling me about how he was just starting up, Simply Saucer with his brother and some friends. And I was telling him was just about to get out of the army. I got out of the army in the beginning of 1974 and went back to Cleveland and rejoined Mirrors. So that late 73, early 74, I was telling him, yeah, I'm going home, I'm gonna get back with the band, we're gonna, see what happens.
It's awesome too, because there's this energy that happens almost around the world too. When you look at like Australia with the Saints and things like that, around 74 or 75, it just starts kicking up where, and I guess prior to that too, with you guys, that there's this sort of youth culture, spontaneous worldwide emergence at that
Yeah,
point.
well, I mean, as I think as we grew, because the baby boomer generation was such a large group of people that, and we started moving along, the technology was there. You had the people that could print and distribute fanzines. So now you could write to these guys, at Trouser Press or Fusion or Phonograph Record Magazine or whatever it was, Opt or what have you. And send them your records, and a lot of them would review them, and they would, and you could put an ad in there and get, your word out a little bit further. So there was a conjunction of not only the musicians making the music, but there were people that were promoting the music and writing about the music. Everyone was starting their own little journey in the music business, be it on whatever level, and they all came together and was kind of like a movement.
And it also feels like it was the birth of a music made by critics, or music made by music obsessives, where, like you're saying, like you guys were deep heads. You knew about the Velvet Underground. This isn't necessarily commercial music at this point. There's an awareness of free jazz music. There's people pulling from independent places all over the world and kind of putting together this sort of like Syd Barrett, like what a touchstone Syd Barrett was, and post Pink Floyd stuff that he did for people. And it just feels like it was the birth of the critical musical culture, which once again permeates punk rock, I think, to this day, where obsessive music fans taking a deliberate approach to making this music as opposed to a commercial approach.
I think that's true, but I also believe that is something that had been percolating, especially like in the R&B groups and things like that coming out of the post-war era. Did not know that much about it at the time that we were doing it, but as I've gotten older, and of course the ability to gather information has gotten better and better, I have read where basically, like the blues guys and the R&B and folks and stuff like that, they were doing the same things that we did in their own cultures to establish their genres of music. So
Yeah, you're.
I think the ability to make music progressed just as alongside the technology to get the music out to people. I mean, before the radio, music was pretty much confined to people's parlors with a piano or maybe a banjo. And after that, you had a radio in the house, and then there was more music, then you had a television, then you had, tapes, DVDs, and phonograph records. And now you've got, I've got that monstrous obelisk over there that, has just more stuff than I can ever watch in my lifetime on it. At my fingertips, this computer at my fingertips has more stuff than I've even could ever imagine that I could have accessed when I was just first starting out this. So I think that has a lot to do with it, is that how the technology and community and everything has worked together in a progression, getting bigger and bigger, intermingling, meshing. We're learning from the people that came before us. Kind of thing, and the people going forward are, using what we brought to the table.
You're right. It definitely is a technology, like you mentioned before, like the advent of the photocopier and the ability
Oh,
to produce
yeah.
independent media, and the tape a few years later, and the tape explosion was huge to metal and huge.
Cassette tapes are probably one of the biggest boons to the independent music industry ever. I have an album called AKA Darwin Lane that I put out a few years ago, and everything on it was recorded in the late 70s, early 80s, and I had been carrying it around on cassettes, these different recording sessions of different bands I'd done. And here in the 2000s, I was able to take those old cassettes to a studio where they could clean them up well enough to put out what I feel is one of my best records.
Oh, it's amazing. That thing's a
It's a
monster.
wonderful record. I'm so proud of that record and so happy that that stuff has gotten out into the world. And to imagine that it was just going around and on a cassette all those years. And without that cassette, probably I never would have had a record of it.
Yeah, because there's a level of economic means to put out a vinyl record. And certainly there's economic means to put out a tape, but the barrier of entry is so low, and to produce your own music, record your own music, capture it, you didn't need a studio anymore. You just needed a tape deck, and you could do it all. And then,
Yeah, everything really is, technology is just an amazing thing. But we could talk about any subject and just think about the technology, how technology has affected it. It's amazing. It's just fascinating times to be alive.
absolutely.
All this.
Well, going back to the mirrors, how much touring were you guys able to do or playing outside of Cleveland area?
I don't ever remember playing outside the county with
Okay.
Mirror. We did not play a lot of, now I left the band in 1975, and that band went on for a few more years. Now they may have played, but I don't, they may have played other places, but I don't know. I wasn't involved in that. But even with Rockets from the Tombs, the brief time that we were together, we did not really play outside of the Cleveland area that much. When I moved to Connecticut, it was a totally different story. I mean, we played, right from the get-go, we were playing all over Connecticut, up the coast of New England, and down into New York, and down that way. I think the opportunities were just there more again, a couple of years along,
Yeah, it's so funny because it is a short period of time when you actually look at it temporally, but it's the leaps that happened between 1974 and 1984 in terms of independent music and the ability to kind of tour and do that stuff. It's
Absolutely, yeah.
a massive 10-year period for that.
Yeah.
With the Electric Eels, were they kind of I know they only did the five shows, but were they kind of like compatriots? I know there's an overlap with members and things like that, but
Oh
were they
yeah. Oh, we all pretty much went to school together, especially the Eels, myself, Mike Weldon, Davey and John and Brian. We're all from the same town, Lakewood, next to Cleveland. And we all knew each other. I've known John since junior high school. And yeah, we were the Eels spare shared a rehearsal loft with Rocket from the Tombs. And yeah, everyone was sort of it, we that was all part of our community.
It's amazing with the Rock from the Tombs. Aaron Melnick from the Cleveland band Integrity was just on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he and I were talking about when you break down that Rock from the Tombs stuff, you've got, in my opinion, the best Dead Boys songs, certainly a lot of my favorite Pere Ubu songs, and plus Peter Lautner's stuff. Like it's there's it's if there was an album that was able to come out of that stuff, it would be the greatest punk record ever made. It's incredible how many, and then you add on top of that the Electric Eels, you add on top of that all the other bands, X-Plank, like all the other stuff that's kind of like around you guys. It's just such a collection of incredibly talented and uniquely minded people that are all in one place at the same time. Like it kind of boggles the mind.
It did. I think that being Cleveland had a lot to do with that, because Cleveland at the time was just a town that seemed to bring in all the outside. You know, we were close enough to New York to have be influenced by New York. We had whatever was going on in the Midwest. You know, Cleveland was always a big part of that. So you were, you know, it was a big media town for the Great Lakes region and things like that. So you were always hearing what was going on from the East Coast to the Mississippi River, basically, in terms of popular entertainment or whatever, what have you, popular culture. So I think that that had a lot to do with that. The Velvets played Cleveland. I never saw them back in their heyday, but they played Le Cave numerous times. And I know that people like Jamie and Jim and Peter and many, many other people saw a lot of those shows, and that was a very big influence on them and us.
Sorry, go on. And I guess that's the other thing about Cleveland is it is such a music town. To this day, there's like a lot of really cool, interesting, specifically rock music, but all kinds of music that comes out of Cleveland.
Yeah, I have not lived in Cleveland for quite some time, but I do visit when I can, and it still is a good music town.
At that time, how many kids were coming to like see bands like the Mirrors and the Eels and the Tombs? Like,
Not a lot.
okay.
Not a lot. Now, Rocket was a different story because my very first show with them was at the Agora opening for Iron Butterfly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, we walk out there and the whole place is full, you know. Mirrors, we'd be playing down at the Clockwork Orange across from the bus station, and there'd be Peter and Charlotte would be there, and maybe a couple of friends of mine, and a friend of Mike's over there, and Paul's wife, and Jamie's sister, and Jim's wife, and that was about it. And maybe a couple of people drinking at the bar. So it was sparse. It was sparse turnout. But we did have some. I mean, I remember we played a show out at Berea, out in Berea at Baldwin Wallace College. And there was a night, it was a nice night. This older man who dressed up kind of like Sun Ra did a light show with us.
Whoa.
And it was just, you know, a lot of fun. And I remember that being, you know, a night thinking, wow, there's a lot of people here. Maybe there were 50 people there, you know.
Was it a heavy psychedelic scene or like a heavy pot smoking kind of scene then, or is it a drinking scene?
I'd say it was more of a weed scene when you could get it. My psychedelic phase was kind of like high school. After high school, I kind of tapered off on the psychedelics. It's sort of, you can, you know, after a while, it's just sort of like, yeah, okay, now what? You know? And I wish that I had that same kind of short duration with alcohol, but I didn't. But that's a whole different story.
It's a lot easier to get the
It
alcohol.
sure was. And once it gets a hold of you, it's a lot hard to get rid of. But lucky for me, I'm coming up on 19 years of not drinking, so
That's awesome.
I'm happy for that. I'm very lucky.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Because, yeah, not everyone made it through, and that's another thing that becomes part of punk's kind of, I don't know, archetype is the fact that there's a heroin eventually becomes a huge problem, and once again, that survives to this day, sadly, opioids and things like that, but substance abuse and people that are drawn to this thing because they're self-medicating, they're experiencing trauma, and I don't want to say it's a cliche, but it is something that happens time and time again.
That's true. I mean, I've had my own problems with that. I've been lucky that I've, you know, made it as far as I have because I have many, many friends who haven't. And it's something that doesn't end just here in the music scene in Indianapolis. We've just had recently a couple of people pass from, well, don't know exactly what it was, but everybody kind of has an idea and best just to let it be, you know. But it is a problem, and I think the problem is that a lot of creative people have a lot of inner pain, And that inner pain manifests itself in many ways. Some people get hyper, super creative and just do absolutely fantastic, unbelievable things. Other people just tear themselves to pieces and they sort of do it in public. And some people think it's great art. Other people, when all of a sudden, when that person, destroys themselves, they say, oh, well, he was just a waste. No, he wasn't a waste. He was they were trying to show you their pain. And, they just couldn't take it anymore. It's very hard. There's a lot of people that are suffering in this world. And some have an outlet to express it and some don't. And I think all of them, all of us need the help that, to get us through those things.
I think especially the art that kind of comes out of this world, because it is real, and the emphasis is on making something authentic. So you're singing a lot of times about your own pain. You're not necessarily Kiss in character up there.
Yes.
You're bleeding for your supper.
Yes. That's true. That's very true. Some many more than others. I mean, some people are just very good storytellers. Other people, the only story they can tell is their own story.
Yeah, well, I guess going back to the more positive side of things here with this music, with Rocket from the Tombs, was there any like I'm sure I've read this, I think, in the Velvets to the Voidoids, but there wasn't really any sort of major label attention, right? There's no path for you guys to kind of really go at that point.
Well, our trajectory was so short and so quick. I mean, it was up and down, in the space of less than a year, really, for that version of Rocket from the Tombs that became the historical Rocket from the Tombs, let's say. We had a little bit of interest. Peter was good friends with Lester Bangs, and we had made this tape. Again, Peter had gone to the local FM radio station and said, "Why aren't you playing local bands on the radio? There's a lot of really good bands here. Why don't you put them on the radio?" And the program director said, "Well, they don't have anything out. They don't have a tape." So Peter said, "So if we brought you a tape, you'd play it." And the guy said, "Yeah." So we went back to our loft, and here, what's today? The 14th. On the 18th, it'll be 39 years, 49 years
That's
that
amazing.
we recorded over a two-night period the basic tapes that became the bootleg. Was it Life Stinks, I think.
Life stinks, yeah.
And then The Day the Earth Met Rocket from the Tombs, that had more some live stuff to it. But we made that tape, and sure enough, they played it on the radio. And all of a sudden, people were interested in us. Like I said, we were opening for Iron Butterfly. Peter arranged to have television come from New York and play in Cleveland. We opened two nights for them. We played with this local act that was breaking out at that time called Left End
Oh,
out of
yeah.
Youngstown, Ohio. And it was things were It looked like things were going really good. And we took the tape out to Birmingham, Michigan, to the offices of Cream, and played it for Lester. And he loved it. He just thought, wow, he was, I'm not saying he was comparing us to the MC5, but he was enthused that we had that kind of energy. And of course, it didn't hurt that we were, I think it was a couple of MC5 riffs in there somewhere, But Lester took it and supposedly played it for the producers of Blue Oyster Cult, Perlman and Krugman. They weren't that enthused.
Oh, wow.
So when the word, I think the word derivative was used, was thrown around, So of course, we're all, I mean, I was 22. I might have been the oldest guy in the band. And I was 22, and we didn't really have anybody older and wiser around us to calm us down when somebody comes around and sticks a pin in our balloon. So we just like were at sea, you know, we didn't know what to do next. So what do? We turned on each other. And, you know, you can't sing. Well, you can't play. Well, you can't play either, but you can't sing, you know. And it just it destroyed itself, unfortunately. I mean, I think that if we had had somebody there, and then this is all hindsight, of course, because when this was going on, I was just sitting there, you know, just like, what am I going to do next, you know, kind of thing. And yeah, I think in hindsight that if we had a calming voice of some sort to guide us there at that point, which is something that, again, as I've gotten older and discovered more, was that most bands that are successful have had someone like that helping them along. You look at Talking Heads, or you look at even television with Terry Orrick and the Ramones, you know. Yeah. They had someone that sort of was keeping everything on an even keel. That's something we lacked. That was something that Cleveland, I guess, was lacking at the time, was having any kind of infrastructure for that kind of managers or something like that, or media people who had an interest. There was no interest in that level of thing going on at the time. I think later on maybe there was.
Well, I think that's also like the geographical privilege some bands have by being in places like a New York, or mm-hmm. like a Los Angeles, or even a Toronto versus Hamilton, like where there is a music industry and there are.
Yeah. That's why people go there too, though. I mean, that's mm-hmm. why most people, when things went sour, most people went to New York. I went up the coast a little further to Connecticut, but basically it was, I wanted to go to the East Coast. And then for a time I thought, well, maybe I should be on the West Coast. And I thought about that for a while. And then I said, no, and I ended up back in the Midwest.
I was going to ask you, like, why did you choose Connecticut over New York? Because obviously Frankenstein goes to New York, and I think Peter goes to New York for a while as well. Right. Or a little bit.
I had been out of the Army for 2 years when Rocket finally broke up and everything had pretty much gone to hell in Cleveland. My family had moved. I wasn't originally from Cleveland. I was born upstate New York and moved to Cleveland when I was young. My father worked for the railroad. And I was out of the Army now. That stuff wasn't look good. I sat down and thought to myself, you know, I want to keep playing music, but the first thing I need is a job. So I got a job on the railroad. And where the opening was in, one of them was in Connecticut. So I thought, you know what? This is close to New York. It's a someplace I'd not been before. So I went out there, and that's how I ended up in Connecticut.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health, or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
It's when you arrive there, is there that, because obviously Gustav Records, there's incredible bands, like what a roster and like a lot of great bands there. But when you get there at first, is that scene already there, or is that something that you kind of
know? I think there were a lot of young bands getting together. I moved there in the fall of 76. By 1978, I had a band together. I'd met more people, and a little scene was starting to come together along the shoreline, out in some of the bars out along the shore between Bridgeport and New Haven. They were starting to allow young punks, if you, for the lack of a better term, come in and play their music on nights when the regular bar bands weren't working, playing covers. So there wasn't really anything solid happening when I got there, but things started happening quite soon after. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time and started meeting all these people, and we started getting stuff together.
Yeah, because it was like, I guess there's only the four singles on Gustav, and then there's like a comp, right, or something? Maybe it's just the four singles that I'm thinking of.
In the era that I had Gustav out in Connecticut, because Gustav's still alive.
Is that your label, by the way?
Yes, that's mine.
Oh, my gosh. If you have any dead stock of a certain kind of Shy sleeves, I have a sleeveless copy. I've been looking for a sleeve for years, but we can talk about that later on.
I might.
Okay.
If I do, though... Those weren't really printed that well, and they get ring wear on them real quick.
Something's better than nothing, Craig. But back to that fantastic ear on that label, the stuff that you put out. I love that Poodle Boys single. Obviously, the Bats is a classic, and all the saucer stuff.
Well, there was some stuff that wasn't necessarily punk that came out on, because I wanted the label to be all sorts of things. You know, if I saw something, there's an album called Tuba City Furnace by this jazz pianist, Robert Griffin. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago, but he came to me with this full complete album of just like sort of slightly psychedelic jazzy piano.
Oh, I got to check that album out.
And we put it out. I have my only copy of it. I don't even think I've ever seen another copy of it. Because when we had that album made, he took the majority of the copies. I put in a little bit of money so it would be on my label. And then he took the albums and sold them however he sold them. I have never seen another copy of it, but I've got one back in here somewhere. As for what we put out at that time, we put out Poodle Boys, Bats, and Saucer singles were the first three releases. And then my next band, The Plan, put out a single. And that was it for singles in Connecticut. The albums were the Bats put out an album. That was the first album. Then there was the comp album. Then there was a 12-inch EP by this rock band called Corporation Lounge. And there was the Tuba City Furnace album, and that pretty much was the Connecticut era of Gustav Records.
You forgot about the one, which is to me is a fascinating record, the Bridge record with the Chronic Disorder 12-inch.
Oh gosh, yeah, I forgot about that one. That's right. And I'm hazing on his name right now, the main guy from Chronic Disorder, but he came to me. And he had put out like 100 copies of that record on his own, and he sold them like crazy. That band like blew up real quick, and he wanted to make some more, but he didn't have the money. So I went in with him and said, well, you know, I'll help you put out this next run if you'll just mention on the label that it's on Gustav Records. And he said, sure. So we did that.
Oh, that's wild.
I forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me about that. I don't even know if I have a copy of that record.
It's a hard record to get. Like, they are a fantastic.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Especially forget the one on Gustav. The exact same record came out before that. That one, I'll bet, is really tough to get.
Yeah.
Gosh, I wish I could remember his name right now.
Is it Spit Respectable? Who?
Spit Respectable, yes.
Oh, here Jason we go. Nottingham. Yeah, there it is.
Nottingham, yes. There it is.
There you go. That to me is they're a great band, because, and you putting out that record, I've always thought was really interesting, because that first scene of Connecticut records that you put out, it's a very power pop, distinct. Yeah. I love the sound. And then obviously Connecticut becomes very much associated with hardcore.
Very much so. Bands out of Bridgeport like CIA and 76% Uncertain. Those guys were great. Oh, we used to play shows with them at this place called Pogo's. I never played the Anthrax, which was a little further towards New York down in Stamford. But Pogo's in Bridgeport. Oh, we had such great shows there with those guys. And so much energy. A lot of
That's
fun.
That's awesome. That is amazing. And also like Saucers, it's like pre-Miracle Legion and pre-Dump Truck too.
Yes, Yep. After that band broke up, both Mark, in fact, I'm going to see both of them. Mike Priggen, who was another guy in that scene over the years, is having his 60th birthday party in Catskill next month.
Oh, awesome. And
I'm going to it because he was like, I think when I met him, he was maybe 13 or 14 working behind the counter at the record store. And he was just like, talk about someone who had like musical knowledge. Mike knew just all sorts of stuff. Anyway, became friends. Once he got a little bit older, he started playing in bands too, has done a lot of stuff over the years. But he's at a record store in New York State for a number of years and going to get back together with them and have some fun next month. But I should see Mark. I believe Mark and Seth are both going to be there from both Miracle Legion and Dump Truck and Saucers. So who knows?
Saucers reunion.
Yeah, if nothing else, we'll get a photograph.
Yeah. Well, it's a, it is such an interesting time kind of post that punk explosion where you do have so many different bands taken in different places. And now it's just, I guess it's ultimately what becomes mainstream rock and roll music at this point. But at that point, it's just amazing where all this different energy is being taken in terms of styles. And
it was a really wondrous, I think the decades of the 70s and the 80s were some of the freest and most wonderful times to be playing music and to be immersed in it and learning and changing and being exposed to so much more diverse stuff. And instead of just saying, oh, well, we can't have a trombone in this because that's not punk. Well, yes, it is punk. Bring the trombone player, you know, and that's what I loved about it. And what I still love about doing this stuff now is that, you know, be as off the wall as you want to be, you know, just experiment with every idea that comes into your head and don't be constrained by anything. And I think that's what the whole ethic of punk was about, was that everything is admissible. Everything can be come into play.
Well, I always say on the show that it's, to me, it's a double helix of sort of highfalutin aspirations and experimentation meets street rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Perubu and the Dead Boys start in Rock from the Tombs, and you have sort of the highfalutin art rock version of punk rock and the real gritty street version of punk rock starting in the exact same place is just, mm-hmm. That's what makes this music so special to me, is because
because the heart of both those things remained with both bands as they went their separate ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it changed, mutated, of course, but I mean, the soul of it was there from the beginning.
What was it like when you saw things like 30 Seconds Over Tokyo blowing up and subsequently years later, some of these Rock from the Tomb songs being covered by like Guns N' Roses, or, you know, like some of these songs being covered by Peter Murphy and all these sorts of different places. Like, it must've been surreal to kind of watch this thing that you did as like a kid.
The Peter Murphy one was for me the best. Was that I was sitting at a friend's house one afternoon with a small television on the table, and I think we were playing cribbage and doing some other things that I won't discuss right now. But nevertheless, we were spending the afternoon together with MTV on, and we're playing, and all of a sudden I hear the dump, 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 and I said, oh, that sounds like, and then all of a sudden the words come in, girls won't touch because I got, and I'm looking at the TV, and by now, you know, they used to have that little icon down in the corner saying who it was and what the song, who was doing the song. Well, by then that had already gone away. So I finally turned to look at the TV, and it's Peter Murphy doing Final Solution on MTV. And I'm pointing to my friend. And I'm going, hey man, you see it? That's my song. I wrote that song. I was one of the writers of that song. And he's looking at me going, you're high. You're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. I said, no. Believe me, it is. And then at the end, of course, they put the thing on Final Solution, Peter Murphy, blah, blah, blah. So next day I went and got, you know, a cassette tape from my house of us doing Final Solution. You know, by that time, almost 10 years previous.
Yeah.
And brought it over to my friend's house and said, "Now listen to this. This sound, I'm gonna, it's gonna, the same song." And I said, "It's me playing that." So that was, I mean, that was wow. You know,
yes, yeah.
That was really, really a wild experience. I thought that the version of "Ain't It Fun" that Guns N' Roses did was really good. They really, I mean, really got the spirit of that song down.
Yeah,
you know, I love that version.
Yeah, that was my first exposure to the song, and as a kid. But then when I finally heard the Rock from the Tombs versions of all these songs, obviously much later, when it got released, because I didn't get the Life Stinks bootleg when it came out. Mm-hmm. It took the Smogvale reissue before I got a chance to really hear the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all there. Like, these songs are, it hits you like, oh my gosh, like the power of that band, and like you're saying, like basically 1 year of true sort of the core existence of that thing.
I felt the same way. I mean, listening to the first Dead Boys album, basically, I mean, you know, the majority of the songs on there are derived from the Rock from the Tombs, and why not? I mean, Cheetah was a riff master. I mean, he's a monster riff maker. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those songs were his, and it was really great to hear him, you know, out in the world. And now, you know, like Sonic Reducer is a punk anthem. Every young punk kid for years that I ran into was just like, oh, Sonic Reducer, you know?
Yeah.
Because that and it is a just monstrous song.
Yeah.
I'm so proud to be part of that, to have helped bring that out into the world.
And I just, like, not even just that song, like the fact, like what you guys brought into the world in terms of a scene where it wasn't Warhol and the Factory, and it wasn't, you know, the MC5. It was just people that love music, making music because they love music. And like you were saying, being free to experiment, like, to me, that's where punk starts, because like all you guys are, all you people are bringing different influences to this stuff. And the stuff you're making isn't necessarily accessible or easy, but it's interesting and fantastic and amazing. And that's what survives this day. Like, I've done 500 episodes of this podcast talking about something that you guys made.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I can't think of another word except just honored to just have been there in the room a lot of times and make my contribution, whatever it was, to any of those songs, and knowing, you know, going forward that you know, I can take that song and take it right back to the first time I heard it, when, you know, maybe it was only half that song, and to think, and I have the memories of making those songs come to life, and that really is just, it's really a special feeling. I don't know how else to put it.
When did you become aware of the Life Stinks bootleg, or were you aware of it?
See, I moved here in 1989. I think it came out right around that time. So I didn't see it till a few years after that. I think I had read somewhere about it. And then I'm trying to think where I got my first copy of it, because I have three copies of it now. I'm trying to corner the market. There's supposedly only 500 of them. I've got three of them.
I've got one, and you're going to pry it from my cold, dead fingers.
You know what? We should get together. It makes us stronger.
That's true. Okay, fine. I'll form an alliance with you. We can combine our record collections.
But I think it probably about 92 or 93. I don't know if you know the Gizmos connection to that.
No, what's the Gizmos connection?
The person who did the cover, next time you look at the album, look at the cover art. It says cover art by Eduardo Flores. That's Eddie Flowers of the Gizmos. I didn't know that until I met the Gizmos, because I knew of the Gizmos, had heard maybe one or two of their songs, until they had a reunion about 10 years ago, and I got into their backing band, you know, for, oh, I don't know, about 6 months. We did a bunch of shows around the Midwest. And then, you know, they went off doing, then they would just started doing something sporadically, and they'd have other people do things, you know. But right a few years after that, Eddie moved from Los Angeles, moved here to Indiana, back to Indiana, and he lives here now. In fact, I'm sitting in his band. On the 24th, I'm going to be playing bass for him because his bass player is going to be out of town.
Oh, that's awesome.
But when we first met, we started talking. He like was kind of like acting a little strange on me. And finally he goes, do you know about the bootleg album? And I said, you mean the Rocket from the Tunes bootleg? Yeah, I have one. In fact, I have a couple of them. He goes, but do you know about, I said, what's to know, you know? And then he told me I did the, you know, that he did the cover art for it. And I just thought, oh no, you gotta be shitting me.
So
I thought that was fantastic.
So, cause I've always wondered who would have been the source for that tape because it wouldn't have been circulated.
I think it is my fault because I believe that I remember there was a guy named Darren Wells who lived in Las Vegas, who was a collector. And I corresponded with him, and I sent him a copy of the what we call the loft tape, the initial five or six songs that got played on the radio. Because I didn't have any of the live stuff. You know, most of that live stuff I never heard about, you know, except for when it got played on the radio. But after that, I did not know, like, that there was a recording of the shows we did with television. It wasn't until probably about 1996 that I found out that that stuff existed, right before the Smogville put the album out.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, now I've lost my train of thought.
So you saw Darren Wells in Las Vegas.
Oh yes, Darren. So anyway, I had sent years before that a copy of the cassette to Darren. I knew him through Chris Stigliano, that used to have a Black to Calm fanzine.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Chris was a big fan of Cleveland music,
mm-hmm.
covered us quite a bit, wrote a lot of stuff about us. And I do believe that, that tape that I sent to Darren became the basis for that bootleg.
Okay.
And if that's not the case, I have managed in the band to have come to take the blame for it anyway. So for better or for worse, yeah, it was me.
Well, I would argue for better because
I agree. I, you know, that stuff kept us alive. That album was a holy grail to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it kept us alive when we did the reunion and did a short. We did a short tour of the Midwest after we did the show, that one show in L.A., which was supposed to be the only time we were going to get together, was to do the show in L.A. in 2003, I think. And then that went well. So we decided, well, we'll do some shows around Cleveland and Chicago and what have you. But we did those shows. Every single one of them was just packed to the gills with people. It was amazing how many people wanted to see us and everything. And the people would come up afterwards just telling us how much it meant to them, you know, to actually see us perform, mm-hmm. because they thought that it was they were expecting the Beatles to get back together before they were going to see us get back together. So that was a really, that year, the 2003, 2004, when we did those tours, was just absolutely amazing. It was wonderful. You know, I just had so much fun on those and just met so many people that are still my friends today.
And it also gave you a chance to kind of appreciate how impactful that, I guess, a bootleg all in the beginning, but those recordings are for people. I would argue that some of the punk's most significant records are bootlegs or unreleased records, you know, like the Screamers recordings, obviously the Rock from the Tombs recordings, the Spunk demos for the Sex Pistols, and there's stuff that if it wasn't, and obviously not condoning the bootlegging and ripping off bands or anything like that, but if these things weren't put out there in this form, I don't know if this music would have developed in the same way. What would Rocket from the Crypt be called without that bootleg?
That's true. I met the lead singer from Rocket from the Crypt in San Diego in 2003 because we started our tour there, and he came to the show, and he's standing out in front of the show, and he's talking to me and Cheetah, and he's going, listen, I swear, we never thought you guys get back together.
Yeah.
But I always thought, I mean, I thought it was interesting that there was a band called Rocket from the Crypt, and I always assumed that we were an influence, because where else would you get that? Because even Rocket from the Tombs, I have no idea. That's something David came up with. I have no idea where he got that from, unless it just came out of his mind, you know? Yeah. And there's no real reference. You know, you didn't take it for, it's not like Plan 9 from Outer Space or something, you know? So I always thought that Rocket from the Crypt had done that, but I thought it was great that he actually came to the show, and he was like, you know, listen, you guys, you're not mad, are you? I'm going, hell, I'm not mad.
I feel like that's also like the ultimate tribute too. Like when you found out about the existence of Rock from the Tomb, it's all of a sudden like, oh, this is like this Easter egg that's been waiting for me the whole time in Rock from the Crypt's name. Yeah. I think for me, I found out about it from, there's like a book about unknown history or unknown legends of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And they talk about love.
I have a copy of it right over here. The writer in San Francisco, I can't think of his name.
Yeah, I'm blanking on it too. I'll put that in the intro. Pre-note.
Richie Uttenberger.
Oh my gosh, you saved me a footnote.
Yeah. But Richie. That was really nice. The sad thing about that was that book came with a CD. And there's no Rock from the Tombs on the CD.
Yes.
Which, I forget why, but I think just, I don't know if there was a production date missed or whatever, but just never managed to get a track on there.
Well, and that was before when Life Stinks was the only available thing. So it was pre-Smogvale recording because
that was years before that. Yeah.
Because that put Life Stinks on my want list. And that began my quest to try and find a copy of it because it was such a tease. Like you're reading about that, this.
Then there was Clinton Halen's book.
Is that the Velvets of the Voidoids?
Velvets of the Voidoids. And then after that, I think it was John Savage's England Screaming came out. And then after that, Legs McNeil's Please Kill Me. Mm-hmm. And those books, you know, there's little mentions of Rocket in all of them. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because that was all, I think, in the 90s. And then all of a sudden at the turn of the century, boom, you know, it's like I had stopped playing pretty much in the 90s, just play very little things here and there. But then all of a sudden that happened and it was like, whoop, you know, here we go again, you know, and it was very nice. I mean, I was very happy because I wanted to, you know, get out there and start playing again. And from Rocket getting back together, I started one of numerous bands that I've had here in Indiana since then. I've made five or six records on my own since then, along with the four records we made with Rocket from the Tombs over the past, 20 years now.
Yeah, it's amazing kind of the second life that band had because of...
Yes. And I think we did some really great work. I have the official Rocket from the Tombs warehouses back here behind this wall. And I have noticed that we are starting to get more people interested in the album Barfly, which I'm great because I think it's a great record. And it's had some really great songs on it. But it's just, you know, it wasn't you know, like before that we had done Redux where we kind of redid the older songs. And then we did Barfly, and Barfly was a whole new set of songs and kind of a different kind of approach. And then the last one we did, Black Record, is more of a kind of on the Tombs album.
Well, this comes up on the show all the time too, is like one of the problems with making music is that eventually you become a victim of people's nostalgia, where they're committed to this one brief moment in your creative existence, and that's what they want you to be. And occasionally, like, obviously people come along and people eventually, like you're saying, they eventually warm up to stuff, but it takes a while because nostalgia is a heavy drug.
That's true. I, to this day, I play Final Solution in my set. Usually end the set with Final Solution. And I was thinking last time I played was in January. And I was thinking as I was playing that song, I've been playing this song for 50 years. 50 years. It's just incredible. And still, it goes over like gangbusters every time. So yeah, you do it sometime. I can see where some artists feel they're trapped in that, nobody wants to hear my new songs, they want to hear the old songs. I look at it, I play the old songs so I have a chance to play the new songs. And if they don't want to listen to the new songs, that's fine. As long as they stick around for the old songs, that's why they're at the end of the set.
And how many people do something in their early 20s creatively that resonates 50 years later with people? Like
That's
it speaks to the power of what it
pretty
was made.
amazing,
Yeah.
amazing, powerful piece of music is what it is. Yeah.
And I feel like a certain kind of shy. I think there's the Saucers stuff is awesome too. Like I think that band, finding out that it was you and there's a connection was a mind blower for me because I just got the Saucers 7-inch with no sleeve at a record store one time. I was like, this is killer. Oh, I love this single so much. And then years later putting the pieces together, yeah, you've got so much incredible stuff. Like you're saying, like to this day you're putting out great music.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. I'm just enjoying I'm enjoying the fact that I'm making music and that I've been able to work with so many incredible people over the years. It's truly, I'm a lucky person to be able to do things that I've lived a life where I've been able to do things I love, and I'm very grateful for that.
And the fact that you're just playing with the guys in the Gizmos or doing stuff with X Blank X and stuff, like it's like a lifetime spent in this music. Listening, you
Yes.
help build, but it's not like you went away and did a techno record and then came back. Like you've always been involved in underground music.
Pretty much. That's what I underground is where I started, and it seems like underground is where I'll stay. But like I said, it's just to be doing it now in 2024, to be sitting here and talking with you, and to be, like I said, 50 years ago, I came home from the army in March of 1974 to come back to Cleveland to play in a band. And here it is 50 years later. I'm still talking about it. I'm still doing it. And it's been a great ride. I can't say enough about it.
I going back now to the very beginning, I've always wondered this. You mentioned the Velvet Underground being an influence on the Mirrors. Were bands like the Fugs or Up at all an influence, or
The Fugs?
yeah, the Fugs?
I believe so. I was aware of the Fugs, and having Mike Weldon for a friend, he turned me on to so much music. And I'm sure that somewhere along there was the Fugs, but I never, that was never something that I was really into, but I'm sure that it influenced others.
What about the Stooges or like the MC5
Stooges
or
were monstrous. The
yeah.
Stooges and MC5 and the Velvets were probably like the triumvirate of what drove us. The Troggs are another band, the Kinks, that sort of hard, gritty art, some of it's R&B based, some of it's just straight up hard charging, power chords. But that is the stuff that really got us excited and wanted us to play music, make music our own like that.
Was there much of a connection between your scene in Cleveland and sort of the stuff that was going on in Akron? I guess it starts a little bit later in Akron, but was there any sort of cultural exchange?
Actually, Akron was going right at the same time that we were, but they be even though it was only like 45, 50 miles between us, there really wasn't much interpollination. I see reading lat again, reading here now in the future about the past, that there was some cross-pollination between, say, Peter going down and playing in the Akron-Kent area. So And we were aware that the James Gang was from Kent, and they were, you know, they had been a popular band in the bar circuit around Cleveland before they broke out nationally. So everybody knew about them. And Mirrors played with Tin Huey a few times, but we never, you know, that would be up in Cleveland. We'd never get invited down to Akron, so we didn't know what was going on down there. And like you said, I left in 76, and I think it was a couple of years later that everything, you know, about Akron came to the fore. But Devo goes back. The seeds of Devo were planted at the shootings at Kent State in 1970. So that was something I think it was going on down there, but hadn't come up to Cleveland by the time, I think right after I left, I mean, like a week after I left is when Devo first played in Cleveland.
Wow. It's so interesting too, because like you said, it is kind of happening simultaneously. And there's bands like Bizarros or River City Rebels that there seems like they would kind of fit sonically better than like Tin Huey or something, but.
That's true. And, you know, I didn't know about the Bizarros until after I had moved away and started discovering what was going on in Akron and about Clone Records and that. And the Bizarros are one of my favorite bands. We just played a show with them last year in Akron, and hope to do more with those guys. I never saw the Bizarros until maybe 2014. I was in Cleveland. We were recording, I think, Black Record, and I noticed in the paper that the Bizarros are doing a show in Akron, and I said, oh my god, I gotta go. So I just drove down there by myself, you know, and saw the show, and afterwards, you know, when it walked up and introduced myself and told them, you know, how much I like those guys, and since then have become good friends with the guys.
Oh, and I love that first single is one of those sort of all-time classics that I feel doesn't necessarily get talked about in as much as some of the other singles from back then.
Do you have their Mercury album?
I had it, but a few years ago I lost that. And also my copy of From the Velvets to the Voidoids I've also found missing today. So I don't have it anymore.
When I sold my record, my wife and I had this wall was a record rack just full of albums. We had tons of them. I have some here now, but we sold our entire collection of thousands of records back in the late, early 90s.
Okay.
And bought, well, we're just going to buy a few CDs, but we bought CDs. But anyway, I kept one album. I kept the Bizarros album.
Oh,
Claudia
wow.
Claudia kept one. She was a big fan of the Yardbirds and kept, I think it was Roger the Engineer. And those are the only two albums from our complete collection that we kept. But I just thought with that Bizarros album, I said, I am never going to see another one of these copies of this record again in my life. Of course, you know, been reissued and stuff like that. But I held on to that because, man, I think that is a complete album. It is just, it's killer songs from start to finish.
Yeah.
And why they never were more popular, I'll never understand, because they seem to be everything that era of music was supposed to be. The Bizarros were.
Yeah, like it really, I guess it really comes down to time and place, right? With yep. a lot of these things, right? Because like
there's I so many
these,
so.
Yeah, there's so many of these bands that are just what you'd think, like this, why didn't this hit? Like it's so perfect for its time.
Mm-hmm. I felt that way about Cleveland. For me, it was the right place at the right time. You know, it just who knew, you know?
Yeah. I got to ask you about your, I guess, Jamie's brother, Andrew Klimek.
Yes.
I love that single he did. I think a couple, 1979 it came out.
No Nonsense? Not No Nonsense.
No, it's got like a Nonsense
Approaching
name.
The Spray Guns.
Yeah.
Approaching the Minimal with Spray Guns. Is that the one?
That's the one. Yeah, I think yes. So.
I, you know, oddly enough, you ask about the sleeve for A Certain Kind of Shy. I have the sleeve to that record, but I don't have the record. And Andrew tells me, oh yeah, I think I've got some down in Jamie's basement. And I said, well, would you go down there and get one for me, please? But he hasn't done that yet, but I'm still hoping. I ran into Andrew came to, I was in New York in June, helping out David when Pere Ubu came over and did two shows to New York and LA last summer. So I came over for the weekend of the New York shows to help David, drove, was driving around town and, you know, and helping him because he doesn't get around too well these days. So I'm sitting working the merch table during the show, and I look over and sitting right next to me, there's Andrew. Out of the blue, I said, how'd you get here? He goes, oh, my friend and I just drove over from Cleveland. Yes, I, when I was, you know, before I went into the Army and was playing in mirrors and things like that, Andrew was about 9 years old. But, of course, he was around. I mean, you know, there was a lot of climax. And so he was the youngest one, but he was nine, you know, he didn't sort of pay too much attention to him. And then now here I am for the last 10 years, I've been in a band with him.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's awesome. Like that all these people are still involved in music too. And still.
It is really nice to know that there's a lot of us still out there doing this. Unfortunately, one by one, you know, things happen, unfortunately, you know, and
And sadly, some people weren't able to be here, I guess, to see this moment happen, which is
that's true.
This has been incredible, Craig. And anytime you want to come back on this podcast and be punished about any of this stuff,
Damien, anytime you would like to have me on, just give me a shout, and I'd love to just hang out and chat with you. I hope to get up to Toronto and have not been back. I don't think I've been back in Toronto since I saw you. And that was, I think, about 5 years ago.
2018.
Oh, it was 18? Oh, gosh.
17? No, 18.
Wow. Whew. Been a while.
Well, next time you do, we'll ride the roller coaster at the X.
Hey, absolutely. Go to the top of CN Tower. You know, in, I think it was 77, my then wife and I came up to Toronto to go to the Canadian Grand Prix. And we were just doing some sightseeing, and they had the CN Tower like half built at that time. And you could go up to like the halfway point, and they had like an observation area so you could look out, and all they had was like, you know, it was an old railroad yard, so there was nothing down there. But that was before the new stadium. You saw all of that, and I just wish I had taken a picture at the time of that, you know, because you don't think Toronto has changed so much. You know, I first came up there by myself in like 1967. And every summer after that, I would just come up and spend like a week. I remember I don't know, maybe it's still around, the Rochdale.
Well, Rochdale, the building's still there.
Yeah.
But they stopped it being a free university when it got taken over by motorcycle enthusiasts, and someone got thrown off the roof.
I don't doubt that, because that's where I ended up crashing the first time I came to Toronto. And then the years coming up afterwards, you know, they told me, hey, anytime you're around, come back. So like 68, 69, 70, that's where I'd stay when I'd come to Toronto.
Wow. So did you come up and see like any of the stuff that was happening in Yorkville back then, like the Ugly Ducklings or any of that kind of stuff?
No, I didn't see any of that, but I did go to the Festival Express at CNE.
Yeah.
I came up for that, and I came up for another show at the stadium. Not the one with John Lennon, but it was like in 69 or 70, I came up for another big rock show in Canada. I can't remember who was playing at that one.
It's not the Alice Cooper one with the chicken, is it?
It might have been.
Oh, wow.
I was pretty high on acid on that weekend, and I don't really remember much of any of it. But I just remember on the way back, hitchhiking back with my friend, that we got stuck outside of Erie, Pennsylvania, and started raining, so we slept under a highway bridge. And that basically is my only memory of that weekend, is waking up under that bridge and then hitchhiking back to Cleveland.
Well, next time you come up here, we got to do a road trip version of this, and we can walk that route and record a podcast walking around Toronto.
That would be really nice. I'd love to see the sights. I haven't really spent some time in Toronto in a long time. Maybe we can get that together soon.
Thank you, Craig, for coming on the show. And I had to cut it short there because I had to do some stuff for the fam. But my gosh, there's a lot more to get to with Craig. So you heard right there, Craig will be back for part two at some point in the future. Check out CraigBell.com. Check out the Gizmos, because Craig plays with the Gizmos. Check out anything this guy does. A legend. A true punk legend. All right, that's it for me for this week on the show. Coming up on the next episode, speaking of punk rock legends, from the band Bratmobile, from Frumpies and Peaches as well, the legendary Molly Newman is going to be on the podcast. This is a great conversation with a very important person in punk and the history of punk, and a very cool person to talk to. Some great stories, some real interesting. Anyway, I'm not going to, why do I have to sell it to you? I just said Molly from Bratmobile is on the podcast and you're going to listen. If you know it's good for you, you're going to listen. All right. That's it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter, the lives and issues faced by Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and different identities, different nationalities, different races, because we're not talking about politics. It's just basic human rights shit. I there's nothing more basic than this stuff in terms of what people deserve. People deserve to be able to live free from hate, violence, and discrimination. Ceasefires are just basic human rights stuff. The right to choose what you want to do with your reproductive system, that's just like a basic human right that people deserve to have. So if there's organizations in your communities that are affecting positive change that you feel could use your support, get involved. Donate your time. Maybe they need some money. You can donate money for administration things or whatnot, but you'll feel better once you get involved. Speaking of things that get better when you get involved, punk. Anyone can do this shit. Like literally any fool. Look at me. Don't waste your life getting addicted to it and throwing everything down the drain, just obsessing with it, being up here in the middle of the night talking to yourself about it. But, you know, you do a lot of things that are a lot healthier than doing a podcast involved in punk. Start a band. Look at Craig Bell. Look what they did. Donate your organs. Sign your organ donor cards, because it makes miracles happen. I've seen it with my own eyes. And try meditating. So you don't have to follow a specific practice. You don't have to buy an app. You just try it. And then if you get into it, then there's other things you can kind of investigate. But just try it and stick with it. Do it until one day it clicks. Because I swear, it feels so fucking good when it does click. And I'm not an expert at all. All right, I'm just rambling now. Thank you, everyone, for listening. See you on the next episode.